Yo, what is a cipher?
Just some people are charged with having to express what people think, and I'm one of those artists.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This was Episode 9, an exclusive sit-down with Talib Kweli, originally recorded in the summer of 2012 at the Rap Genius offices in Brooklyn. Talib Kweli's masterful use of poetic devices, social and racial consciousness, and wordy, syllable-packed verses were first heard by a wide audience on the 1998 album with his longtime friend Mos Def, now Yasiin Bey. Mos Def and Talib Kweli are Black Star. Since then, Kweli has had a string of successful collaborative projects with the likes of High Tech, Madlib, and Reese, as well as a series of popular solo albums and mixtapes. At the time of our conversation, he had just released the mixtape Attack the Block. We began our conversation by talking about his penchant for creative, unusual similes. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, make sure to check out episode 54, a talk with Kweli's old label boss, Brian Brader of Raucous Records. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, your favorite rapper's favorite Twitter personality, Talib Kweli.
We were talking before. You mentioned something about similes and use of similes in rap, and that brought to me to one of the first things I wanted to ask you, which is, I know you talked about overuse of similes, but you're really a master of that form. I feel like you use similes in really creative, unexpected ways and unusual ones, you know, even from the earliest days. It's a small wonder like Vicky.
Really, to me, it's a small wonder like Vicky. Why I'm picky. These niggas suck like hickeys. I still get to slip they shit in like Mickey's. I'm sick of these hating players.
She's a small wonder. Lovely.
What to you makes a good simile?
I'm old school with it, and I come from a style that I think is really pioneered and developed by like Lord Finesse and AG and Big L. Where it was like, it was really, even though I'm from Brooklyn, that was more of an uptown thing, where it's like, similes were short, to the point, but just really kind of just focused and hard-hitting. And those dudes, that was a battle style, you know, and that's that's the sort of the style that I grew up writing in. I try to make my similes have layers. You know, preposterous like an androgynous misogynist.
Depressing the optimist. You stopping us preposterous like an androgynous misogynist. You picking the wrong time. Stepping to me when I'm in my prime like optimist transforming.
Has a certain amount of layers. But there's different ways to do it. You know, there's a you know, right now they're doing sort of a style now where it's like similes but without the like or as, like
hashtag rap or whatever.
Yeah, or it's like a word association rap.
Swimming in the money, come and find me. Nemo, if I was at the club, you know I balled. Chemo, drop the mixtape.
So that's the simplistic way, and there's an art to that too. But I think that's the thing where you got to figure out, sort of get in where you fit in. And I've been criticized for my overuse of similes or simplistic similes, like episode 2, like Attack of the Clones.
Dusk and the crack of the dawn, we go through episodes too, like Attack of the Clones. What till we break a bag and you hear the crack of the bone?
Which to me is fun and has layers, but other people is too sort of there for the taking. But I feel like I balance it out with subject matter and with going in other places that I sort of use the real simple similes as sort of like, you know, connectors to right. connect the deeper ideas.
Right, like you were saying about the Family Guy thing, it's something everyone knows.
Right.
You use homophones or near homophones a fair amount in your work, right, words that sound the same but are spelled differently or mean different things. You use custom auto and custom auto.
These niggas keep it bottled. I'm the writer who reached the fighters like speeches but custom auto. DJs stick at the vinyl like fucks and rattles. Supplies ride around the block in the custom auto.
Which is one of my favorites, Euthanasia and Youth in Asia. So I was wondering about how using a device like that works for you. Do you think of the homophone first and then try to find a way to work it into a lyric?
Yeah, I think, you know, and for any writer, especially a rapper, words and word combinations are jumping into your head at all times. It's like there's a clip of on the internet from a long time ago of Eminem and Proof just coming up with different word combinations. They weren't even fully developed rhymes.
That's my brother Nate, and I hate the fact that we never had no food on our plate. So then Proof said, what up, M? Yo. So I said, Proof, don't you come in?
Yeah, yeah. Come in, what's up with that? Tango and Cash, Kane and Mango and Blast. Together, tougher than Alcatraz, prison bars. Driving foreign cars. Yes, it's me and my man, Capadre, black and white.
It was them, and I guess it was an exercise they used to do. And that speaks to what MCs do all day. And so I think with the custom auto, it was just something that just jumped in my head. And I had to figure out how to use it in Iran.
Right. Cool. I noticed you're wearing an Idol Worship shirt for our podcast listeners who can't see. Your collaboration rock band, for lack of a better word.
You have me caught in your spell. I am not your enemy. You approach me like my enemy. Get closer to my enemy. You smoke you like my enemy. I'll beat you like my
Rock band is ambitious. You know,
yeah.
If you say we're a rock band, I'm like, man, you know, we're doing good. Rock is we definitely do a rock and roll show.
Yeah,
but it's different types of music. That's all a woman.
Yeah, yeah. It's so that if I'm correct, it's the first time you've teamed with a singer rather than a producer or a rapper for a sort of full length collaborative project.
Yeah, I mean, Reese is somebody who I work extensively with, and she's been on most of my projects, if not all of them.
Yeah.
And so it made sense to do something with her.
Nice. And what did you learn through the process of collaborating on a full album with a singer as opposed to any of those other type of artists?
Well, I got to fall back and play the background. My impact on that album is more in production than it is on my actual rap verses. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I learned that I really like the group dynamic, and I really like being a piece of the puzzle. I can do the solo thing, and the solo thing has helped me to pay my bills.
Sure.
But I really like the collaborative effort.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You've been very open about that, about preferring the collaboration, stuff like that. Even in your solo projects, you'll go out of your way to bring shine to your collaborators, like put pictures of them in the liner notes of your collaborators and things like that. Why do you have such an emphasis on that, as you once put it, the collective we?
No, this was done by the collective we. Even if my name is on the record sleeve, I ain't into gravity.
I think it's more honest. You know, I'm not Prince. I'm not Kanye West. I'm not like writing the hooks and singing the hooks and making the beat and doing the mix. And, you know, I'm not doing that. So when you see a solo album from me, it's a mix of a bunch of different talents, and I feel like it's more jazzy that way to me. It's more like jazz music, where you're really acknowledging everyone's piece of what came together.
Excellent. I wanted to jump back in time for a second. On the Right About Now tune, where you're sort of going over your career history up to that point, you pinpointed one moment, I think, if I'm reading it right, where the underground sort of started, the underground scene you were first involved with, the raucous thing, sort of started to die, and that was the sale to MCA.
Workers gotta deal with MCA. It's the gray area, the letter stood for Music Cemetery of America. They try to fool you by switching the name to Geffen. Now they Interscope's bitch, and every artist who had a chance left them. Ain't no big surprise, wasn't no love there. Jimmy Iovine never signed me. I just kinda ended up there, but fuck that. Literally.
How did that look to you at the time? Were you excited, apprehensive, indifferent?
MCA. You know, up until then, there was industry slang for MCA, the Music Cemetery of America.
Right.
And is because they were known for taking viable acts and killing them. But we had faith in what MCA was trying to do. They had The Roots, they had GZA, they had Mary J. Blige, they had Mos Def, they had Common, Blackalicious. It just felt right. All those artists were artists who I felt that I could align myself with. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize was the reason why they had all those artists, because all those artists had small to marginal to large followings that were already developed before they signed.
So they didn't have to do any work.
They didn't have to do anything. They didn't have to do anything. So that's why they chose those artists. They weren't trying to develop any new talent. Mm. And what they did was they allowed those projects to just come out and do what they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And they just reaped the benefit.
Okay. Now, looking through your... I revisited most of your catalog before talking to you today. And it popped out to me there are three words that recur over and over and over again in your work. From its earliest days through today, and those are revolution. Spiritual. And love.
We're gonna have the word love in many different languages.
Those are good words.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd explain maybe what each of those mean to you and why you think those play such a large part in your thinking and your writing.
Well, revolution is change, and change is something that's extremely spiritual to me, and that change is God. What we're dealing with constantly is change. And even with my career, and the type of artist I am, my fans a lot of time want to go back in the past and back to old school and back to the way it was and back to the origins of hip hop. A lot of them don't even understand what the origins of hip hop are to be so demanding and insistent that we go back to the origins.
Yeah.
But it's important that I recognize the trends and I recognize the changes and I remain myself in that. It leads into the spirituality thing because I truly believe that at the end of the day, that's what God is. God is that which creates change. And so I think the spiritual question is something that on different levels we all deal with. Everyone has their own way of dealing with it, but we're all constantly thinking about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Just some people are charged with having to express what people think, and I'm one of those artists. And then love, I think that's the whole reason why artists even do music. Even the most hardcore rapper really wants to be doing a love song. We want to talk about love. That's the driving force behind why we do it. We want to be loved. We want to talk about love. We want to be in love. And, that's why underground rap fans, in order to not be soft, underground rap artists, in order to not be looked at as soft, they don't make songs about busting a gun. They make songs about how much they love hip hop. And it's just really about love.
Right. Keeping the spirituality thing going for a moment, that tune Give 'Em Hell of yours sets up a pretty strong dichotomy between religion on one side and spirituality on the other. So it all sound the same to me. That's why when they say one's right and the other's wrong, it just sound like gain to me. It's like I skipped past the church and came to me. No, that ain't vain to me. It's just a particular way that I came to see the difference between those who claim to be religious and those who say they're spiritual. I recognize that life is full of miracles. You can see my glow in the... Do you really see those things as separate or opposed?
No, there are plenty of religious people who live their life based on spirituality, mm-hmm. regardless of what religion they're in. Religions at best can change people for the better and make people want to live and be the best that they can be. So I'm not like against religion. I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I know God, and I'm not. But I don't like what religion, the role religion has played in terms of being a catalyst and the justification for a lot of intolerance, a lot of bloodshed in the world. And I think it's something we have to be honest about.
Okay.
And I think too often people who practice religions do so without knowing the history of those religions.
Mm-hmm. That's something that song deals with a lot. It's pretty critical of the sort of history of Christianity, or at least its doctrines. Taught that if you don't know Jesus, then you lead a hollow life. Never question the fact that Jesus was Jewish, not a Christian, nor that Christianity was law according to politicians. Who was King James? And why did he think that it was so vital to remove chapters and make his own version of the Bible? They say hell is underground and heaven is in the sky. And they say that's where you go when you die.
how they know.
Were you ever worried about releasing that song? Like, hey, maybe my fans who are Christians aren't going to like me pointing out some holes in their
theories. You know what's crazy? To be honest, a lot of those type of fans are so Bible-thumping and dogmatic that they don't even hear what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of my fans who... And being on social networks, I see this, you know? Like, I have 500,000 or so people follow me on Twitter.
Right.
And I'll say something that's along the lines of that song, and a fan who I know heard that song will get upset.
As if you'd never said it before.
Right. Yeah. And so it makes me realize that there's a level of religious obedience that goes beyond you even being able to hear or ingest anything critical or anything factual about your belief system.
Okay. Speaking of things that are touchy and that people might not want to hear, I was re-listening to Around My Way, and the thing about that tune that struck me, it criticizes that outpouring of patriotism post 9/11.
I thought you were going to say people were mad because I sampled Saints Day. I was listening to that, and you sampled Sting. What was up with that?
No. There's none of that here. So, obviously, you're both a lifelong New Yorker, and thus a connection to the obviously terrible events of that day. And you're someone who travels a lot outside the United States, and this maybe has a different perspective than people domestically. So, how did you feel about that kind of outpouring of patriotism and a flag on each house and that kind of stuff? And then beyond that, why did you choose to speak out about it?
Well, you know, I felt like the outpouring of patriotism around that time was fake in a lot of ways, because there's nothing wrong with being a patriot. You know, I think the people, the movement behind things like Occupy Wall Street, very patriotic movements.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider myself a patriot. But I do consider myself a product and a beneficiary of these great United States.
Yeah.
But you know, for me to say I was a patriot would no. I mean, you know, I'm an advocate for people on a base level, on a community level, way before I'm a patriot for some sort of national country's viewpoint. You know,
sure.
And so I feel like there's a lot of people who jumped on, who, you know, there's people, that's when you realize that the fuck Bush thing is a bandwagon thing.
Sure.
When as soon as people get a little bit scared.
Which was happening right around the time you released that record, right? 04, right?
Right.
Around there, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people who were just on that, saying they didn't like George Bush, but just because it was a popular thing to say.
Right.
Not because they really didn't understand why they shouldn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
And those people changed their tune as soon as we got bombed. And they were looking for strength and a leader. And George Bush, for all intents and on a political level, showed political strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so people got behind that. And it kind of surprised me a little bit. Maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised. But I think that's why I was talking about it, because I was like, really? Y'all down with George Bush now? Like, I didn't really understand.
Sure. And you mentioned the Occupy movement there a second ago. You've been very supportive of that, obviously, appearing at the encampment. You did the distraction freestyle there. And
this beautiful culture, scavengers, feasting on the dead like a vulture, snagging. How you keeping up with my rapping? You barely keeping up with Kardashian. You put up a distraction. It's delivered proof. You try to make the truth elastic. That's Mr. Fantasia.
Shot a video there and all that kind of stuff. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Occupy and your involvement in it or support of it.
I just think that type of movement is exciting. I think anytime people are willing to take their future into their own hand and attempt something, I think it's brave. I think the same thing about the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party is the same thing as Occupy, except with done by racists. But I mean, I applaud them, what they were able to do. I mean, the power they were able to achieve. They hijacked the Republican Party. It was incredible to watch. Yeah. I mean, I don't agree with anything that they say. I mean, I think the Tea Party doctrine was very hypocritical. But, I mean, things like that, the fact that people can get up off their ass and do something like that is exciting to me.
Yeah, and you've been very, traditionally, very supportive of those kinds of movements as opposed to, say, voter registration drives or whatever. I know you have mixed feelings on voting, but you've obviously been much more supportive of that kind of more direct action.
Yeah, as I grow into more of an adult than a rapper, voting, I still feel the same about voting, but I see the power and maybe raising candidates from the childhood level, or, you know, working on creating voting blocks, you know, having blocks of voting power, rather than convincing people that their individual vote means so much. All these people died for you to have the right to vote for an electoral college, or, you know, it's just like.
Yeah, there's one more vague, sort of Occupy-related thing I wanted to talk to you about. Kanye West visited Liberty Square last year, and as you know, and Jay-Z was photographed wearing an, you know, pro-Occupy shirt that Rockaware briefly produced. And to me, looking at that, it was like, rather than appreciating the support or trying to open up a conversation with either artist, some, far from all, but some, you know, Occupiers took these opportunities to single out those folks as, oh, they're members of the 1%, they're evil, rather than seeing them as traditional allies. And I was wondering what you thought about that kind of criticism that was meted out to both of them from some, you know, segments of the Occupy movement.
Well, I do think that, you know, it was a misstep on Rockaware's part to try to produce that shirt. But I don't doubt Jay-Z's sincerity or his intentions in wanting to participate in something like that. And I think, you know, I have a unique position of being behind the curtain. With Kanye, without a doubt, definitely, I watched him from being a broke artist that no one knew until one of the biggest artists in the world.
Sure.
Jay-Z, I didn't know personally. But I'm from the same place he's from, and I grew up with his music, and I grew up watching him from being a Hawaiian sofa video to creating this empire.
Yeah.
And so I understand their struggle, how it starts, where it comes from, where their hearts are, and the way that I approached them is not as superstars or megastars that are untouchable. I approached them as people who came from the same place I came from. They just were more fortunate when it came to material wealth. I think a lot of people who are critical of them don't have the luxury of seeing that background or understanding that story. They are beaten the head by corporate interests, record companies and radio stations, with songs by these artists, songs and imagery that they may or may not like or appreciate or get into. Yeah. And so it becomes something where it becomes like a hostile relationship. Like, why do I have to listen? Why do I have to like Kanye West? Why do I have to like Jay-Z? Well, no, you don't. But they feel assaulted. I feel like it's the same with Drake, who didn't go to Occupy Wall Street, of course, but you know, when I look at the history of Drake, when I look at how he came out on the mixtape scene, to me, his first couple mixtapes was incredible, and he was shouting out Slum Village and Lil Brother, and shouting out
the whole
out
Houston scene, and all
Leah
that.
Doing the whole Houston thing. I thought that was dope, but if you're the average fan who only gets your information from mass media, then the first time you heard Drake, he was signing Young Money, and the radio was playing songs four times a day, right. And you're four times an hour, and you're like, oh, you feel assaulted. You don't know the story, so you don't factor that backstory into this person that you're looking at. And that goes for Russell Simmons, that goes for Kanye West, that goes for anybody.
Goes for Diddy, obviously, who you knew from way back.
Yeah, I mean, these are people who started from the ground level. Diddy used to come to Lyricist Lounge.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I feel blessed that I was able to witness that, because it gives me a far better perspective on the realities of what these artists are, what they've done to make it.
Yeah. One more thing in that vein. So I heard the interview you did with Aisha Tyler, and you talked about Watch the Throne on that.
You know, that album is a black album.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about a lot of community stuff, and they don't get props for it.
Mm-hmm.
People are so focused on the myth.
Mm-hmm.
People are so focused on whatever Jay and Kanye are wearing or who they're going out with.
Yeah.
That they're missing, that these guys really, they represented the club and materialism as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they really represented for black people on that album.
You mentioned something about it that I thought far too few people talked about, which is, to me as a listener, it was an album specifically about black people and black culture and this idea of like a black elite class in America and wrestling with and that being new and wrestling with what that means.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering what it was like for you to hear two of the biggest stars in the world addressing some of the same topics that you as an artist deal with regularly and have for a long time, and then to see their efforts largely misinterpreted or dismissed as like, oh, it's all luxury rap or whatever.
Well, it goes back to that celebrity worship thing. People got so caught up in the imagery. Like people, even the biggest Jay-Z and Kanye fans, got so caught up in the packaging and the presentation of Watch the Throne, the event that Watch the Throne became, that what they were actually saying on the album got lost in the sauce. And I think it's a perspective thing. The first time I heard Watch the Throne, you know, I went to Kanye's hotel room in the Mercer, and he played me Murder to Excellence, and he played me Made in America. Those are the first two songs I heard of. And I'm like, this is where y'all going with it? Like, this is really heavy subject matter.
Yeah.
Then I heard Ham, which was totally different, and even kind of reverted back to the sounds, like the Maybach Music sound of last year or a few months ago. Yeah. So I felt like that was like a backward step, but it worked. Even though some of my fans may not have liked it, it worked in the clubs and the radio at the time.
Yeah.
You know, Niggas in Paris is just such a powerfully arrogant race record, you know? And then it's like, you know, even with the, you know, it's luxury rap over the Otis sample, but it's still like the same type of sampling and chopping that you would hear from a Pete Rock or a Premier. So I wasn't, you know, that appealed to my senses. I think me hearing it that way and thinking that this is what they're doing, that's how I heard it when I first got it. But I think most people, they hear Flex dropping bombs on it, or they see the guy from Givenchy design the cover or something like that. Like, they see all this other stuff that really don't have anything to do with the music, and that's how they approach it.
Okay. Now, getting back to you and your sort of peer group of rappers, you're about 3 to 4 years younger than a lot of the rappers generally considered your peers, people like Pharoah and Yassine, Common, Black Thought. Now, obviously, I'm sure that, you know, makes no difference now, but when you were starting out, did any of those guys, were any of them like a mentor to you? Did you have any kind of like mentor-mentee relationship with any of them when you were starting out?
Oh, yeah, I mean, with Mos Def, almost more than anybody, Yassine, I mean, I learned a lot of my style, just a lot of the way I present myself from him. Mm-hmm. The Roots and Black Thought in particular have undeniable impact on my craft. Common was one of the first people to take me under his wing, without a doubt. But then there's people who people would expect, like a DJ Quick, somebody I spent a lot of time with early in my career, who was really helpful.
Which is funny, because to your fans, that collaboration just seemed to come out of the blue.
I draw blood like mosquitoes, y'all annoy like now. Pop that around the wrong cat, get laid flat. Concrete adjust to the contours of your back. Quick, wait, back.
Yo, I'm in the back room making a run. Ain't even touched her and making her come. You can catch me out in Portland with start of mine. Everybody doing shows, but I'm the hottest fly. Bitches saying honest.
Well, the collaboration did come out of the blue, but our relationship developed from that collaboration. Quick as a producer, High Tech just as a producer, appealed a lot to a lot of West Coast people. And so when The Blast came out, both Quick and Snoop had radio shows on I forgot the name of that station. It's not even The Beat in LA. And they both used to play that song. And that's how High Tech ended up working extensively with Snoop, and I ended up working extensively with Quick. So, you know, I didn't know how that record was going to sound, but we spent days and days in the studio when we went to work on that record.
Going back just for a second to the beginning of your career, the Black Star record, a lot's been said about it. I don't particularly want to spend a lot of time on the Black Star stuff, but I've rarely heard you comment on what to me seems the most obvious thing about it, which is that it seems in large part to me the record as a project is a tribute to the hip-hop that you and Mos loved growing up.
1, 2, 3, the crew is called BDP. And if you want to go to the tip top, stop the violence in hip hop. Why, yo?
It's like 1, 2, 3. Mos Def and Tyler, one. We came to rock it on to the tip top. Best alliance in hip hop. Why, yo?
Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, where laws were stern and justice stood, and people were behaving like they ought to good.
Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore Adidas and lived life slow, when laws were stern and justice good, and people was behaving like hip-hop was good.
Here's a little story that must be told.
About two cool brothers that were put on hold.
They tried to hold us back for fortune and fame.
They destroyed the crew and killed the name.
Come on, y'all. Here's a little story that must be told.
About two young brothers who was put on hold.
They tried to stop a goal.
We on a spiritual plane.
Tried to kill the pride
and destroy the name.
We just too bad.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, how important was paying homage to the culture for you,
specifically in making that album, that collection of songs?
But that's an interesting question, because Mos Def, Yassine, is, you know, approaches hip hop from an undeniably more pure place than I do. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn, but my parents were academics, and it was like it was school and it was writing, and so in my style, my style, especially back then, was very kind of loquacious and very all over the place and more like spoken word. Mm-hmm. I approach hip hop back then, and I'm better at it now. But back then, from a very sort of intellectual, heady, ambitious approach, whereas Yassine was more about the rudiments. He knew about graffiti and b-boy culture a lot more than I did.
Right.
And it was all those all that going back to Double Trouble and, you know, stuff like that was more him. You know, it was like when you hear the sample from Chameleon Street and the little voice samples that come at the beginning of the record, and when you hear and that's more me.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.
Ask a son. I want to know. I want to know who you are.
Yes. That's more like adding the cultural aspect, like the sort of Last Poets vibe to it. That's more me. The old school b-boy homage to the culture stuff, that was more Yasin.
Okay, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. Moving to another genre of rap, Country Cousins, that record here. I thought it was really important in terms of the relationship at the time between New York City and the South. I walk and talk kind of fast and thought of as a New York kind of rhymer. But most New Yorkers got family in South and North Carolina. L.A. is little Alabama. They walk and they talk with a country grammar. New York think everybody else sound country. So we started calling them Bama. Down South when we buy them hammers. Down South when we sell them drugs. Down South where life is cheap, but they quick to fill you with them slugs. It's nothing. Can you talk a little bit about why you decided to respond so directly to the way so many New Yorkers were kind of looking down their nose at the Southern rap that was popular at the time?
Well, I developed a relationship with Bun B, who I forgot to mention is one of the people who was very influential.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about him.
Early in my career, I had the benefit of going to Cincinnati and spending time out there. And in Cincinnati, they were listening to East Coast hip hop, but they were also listening to Master P and E-40. And I didn't get those artists off top at first. But I understood from being in Cincinnati that it's not always about like rules of how you should do hip hop. Music is about making people feel, and music is about what's actually going on in people's lives. And Master P and E-40 were talking a lot more about what was actually going on in these kids in Cincinnati's lives than rappers from New York, even though they were listening to more New York hip hop. That sort of changed now. Down South style has taken over. In Cincinnati, they listen to more Down South style music now. As the whole country does, actually.
Right.
But that was an education for me to understand early that hip music is based on where you grew up and what you were dealing with emotionally when you heard it. Mm-hmm. That's why most people like what they heard in high school and college more than anything, because that's when they were coming of age.
Yeah.
And so where they grew up at, if you're a dude from down south who was coming of age as in high school in the early 90s, you know, you might like Outkast, but if you're from Atlanta, you come into high school, coming to age of high school more recently, you might like Soulja Boy in the future. You know, it depends on your region and what you were dealing with. And it would be very unfair for me to judge someone's musical taste based on how I grew up and how old I am. And I think people do that way too often.
Absolutely. What is about Bun? You mentioned him. You've collaborated with him. I saw the show you did at Brooklyn Bowl where you brought him to perform, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Both personally and as an artist, what do you like about him? What makes him sort of this iconic, super respected figure, you know, across the board?
Well, one, Bun B is a member of UGK. UGK is one of the realest groups ever in hip-hop. And the legacy of Pimp C, what people don't realize is the way that hip-hop looks at Tupac, the realness, all that, that's how the South looks at Pimp C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jay-Z realized that being a hustler, realized that when he made Big Pimpin'. That was the first time New York had ever gotten into UGK. That was the first time I got into UGK around Big Pimpin' era.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I went back and got all the other stuff that I missed, Coming Out Hard. You know, I met Bun just because Bun is everywhere.
Right.
And we developed a friendship, and we ended up doing a song together on a mixtape for Static Selecta. And I started noticing how Bun really picked up the torch for UGK when Pimp C went to jail. That was something I respected. I think he's an incredible lyricist. I think he doesn't sacrifice none of that down south swag, none of that. He don't sacrifice nothing, but he comes with a style and content that even the rap nerds can get into. And I feel like he's the perfect person to make that type of transition.
So on Respirations, changing topics for a second, you talk about New York as the Roman Empire state. And to me, that's such an evocative phrase. Really, just a whole range of associations to it. And it shocked me that it had never been used before. It felt that instantly familiar. And I was wondering if you could talk about that and maybe what the signs you saw at the time that made you think, okay, New York or the U.S. or whatever is an empire in decline.
It's a tricky thing because, you know, when you think of empire, you think of something that is very big and naughty and about to fail. Right. And nothing seems more like that in today's world than New York. You know, I'm not praying for New York's downfall by any means, but I just recognize, you know, some of the ways that our government is run, some of the decadence, some of the things that are just come naturally for a big city, are things that you see echoes from the past. You see things like that happen in the Roman Empire, and if you don't pay attention to the past, you're doomed to repeat it. So, you know, that's just what it was. You know, it's just...
Wow, okay. Now, your songs across the board contain a really wide variety of literary references, more so than just about anyone can think of.
I asked him why we follow the law of the bluest eye. He looked at me, he thought about it, was like I'm clueless. Why? I'm length of huge dream, the first seen the hurt in the flesh, because so many people believe the word even when it seemed absurd.
Now, as you obviously worked in bookstores growing up and things like that, and your parents are academics, as someone who spent so much time around books, up to and including at one point, or maybe you still do, I don't know, owning a bookstore, have you ever thought about writing a book?
I'm writing a book now. I'm writing a couple books. One is about my albums, mm-hmm. and the other one is more autobiography.
Wow. Okay. Can we any time frame on those?
No. I'm just writing them. I'll try to put them out when I'm finished.
Excellent. Jumping back to the social media thing for just a second. On Twitter, every once in a while, I'll see some fan, undoubtedly a kid, criticize you for being a rich rapper, right? They have this, and so there's this, I was wondering, without getting into your personal situation at all, what you made of this particular segment of the internet who thinks that everyone they see on TV, every celebrity they hear about, is rich and famous, especially in this era where the reality is, as you put it on Uh-Oh, you said there ain't no more money in rap.
If you're wondering why I do stress upon your rap, they need attention, dog, there ain't no more money in rap. So if you're mixing with GarageBand videos on the flip cam, I'm a big fan, you got more heart than breath to hit, man, but shit damn.
Yeah, that happened long before the internet, long before social media. Now they can just say something to you about it. That's right. The only difference. But, you know, I remember Jessica Caire Moore saying that when she's, you know, a poet from Detroit. You know, she said when she would be on the subway, when she had finished winning on Showtime the Apollo, people would always be like, why are you on the subway?
It's like, I need to get where I'm going.
Right. She's like, I just won Showtime at the Apollo. It's not even like... You know, it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. What do people think that you, when you're on TV, that you enter through some magical portal where all your bills are paid?
Right. And you know every other celebrity.
Right.
Naturally. Yeah. That's wild. So, and what is it like to interact so directly with people who actually think that and to see it, like, in real time as they're saying it?
I mean, it's good that you point out that they're kids because that's something that I could stand to pay more attention to. But, you know, I try with the social media to... approach it the same way I would approach anyone on the street. And that's to check somebody if they're out of line and to thank somebody for the praise and try to find a balance with that. And, you know, I think sometimes you can go over the top either way, but I think for the most part, the fans appreciate my efforts to try to keep it as authentic as I possibly can.
Absolutely. I wanted to sort of veer off for a second. I was wondering your thoughts about the movie Bamboozled, and I'll tell you why I ask. Both because it's one of my favorite movies, and obviously you know at least one of the stars, or two.
I think I might know everybody in that movie very well.
And there are echoes of it in your work. On the quality record, you have Michael Rapaport essentially reprising his character from that movie.
The bottom line is, I want to get bigger. I want to get better, all right?
Bigger is better.
And I want to get deffer, if you want to quote the, you know... Okay, James Todd.
Ladies love. Ladies love him.
Why not? Why shouldn't the ladies love him? He's a good looking guy. Why shouldn't they love him? I wish I had the pecs on that guy. Now listen to me.
On one of the same tunes where you have Saving Glover and everything.
I grew up with Sarah and I grew up with Mose and and so Mums. His Mums is in there. He's one of the Mose's crew.
So it's just one of your thoughts on the movie.
I almost worship Spike Lee, you know, and I'm a huge Spike Lee fan, and I think Bamboozled was extremely brave. I think that as a filmmaker, just with how he filmed it, and the fact that he tried his best to make as literal of a satire as possible,
yeah.
I think it was just a brave choice. I don't think it's for everybody, yeah. But I mean, I personally love the movie.
Absolutely, and it's funny because even though he announces literally at the beginning that it's a satire, still people didn't get it,
yeah.
or some people didn't get it. Very cool. I wanted to ask about the Black Star Aretha project. The song you released from it is incredible.
I'm on solid ground, I'm far above the clouds. Simmer eagle easing on down, black in the press.
Way more than just a stereo filler, rising above it. People loving our material riller. We spit heavy, Rick Perry is a serial killer. The kid carry at the prom with a bucket of blood. It gets scary.
And I was wondering if there's any more in the works, maybe what the status of that might be.
I mean, the honest answer to that is, you know, I just try my best to get music out when me and Yasin do music. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when or if anything else will ever come out from that.
Sure.
You know, I focus on what I got to focus on. And when Black Star things pop up, I'll be the first to let y'all know.
Okay. Excellent. Just winding on, one more thing I wanted to ask about your style that I always wondered. So on The Beast, you have this lyric about you compare your style to a mix of like Rakim and Kane and Rick and Biggie and P and Ice Cube.
Talk back, spiritual like Rakim, I'm nice like Kane with the females. Slick Rick, Biggie Smalls, attention to detail. Political like P.E., I'm spitting fire like Ice Cube. Quality a nice dude till you start fucking with my food.
Now, other than that list, which obviously is pretty formidable, and you mentioned a few other people here, you know, Yasin in particular. Are there any other artists while you were coming up and forming a style that you maybe consciously patterned yourself after?
Yeah, Mike and Nine, Freestyle Fellowship,
mm-hmm.
Had an influence on my style. You know, those people you mentioned, is Q-Tip in there?
No.
Q-Tip and De La Soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you had, you know, the Inkiru Bookshop. Or cultural center now, I guess. How did the reality of actually owning it differ from what you thought when you thought, oh, well, okay, now we can afford to buy it and help it out and all that kind of stuff? How did the day-to-day reality of owning it differ from what you thought it might be?
Well, we really didn't know what we were doing when we were trying to run that business. I mean, bookstore business was already something that was becoming archaic.
Mm.
You know, yeah, we really didn't know what we were doing at all.
What is the status of that now?
Oh, it hasn't been around for years.
Okay. Excellent. And finally, the Prisoner of Conscious record, very, very great, very layered, evocative title, is in the works, almost done. What's the story with that?
Yeah, I got a mixtape that I think I'm calling Attack the Block coming out in a couple weeks.
Oh, love that movie. That's...
Me too. And then that'll be the prelude to POC.
Okay. Excellent. Talib Kweli, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been an updated version of a previously released episode of The Cypher. Visit thecyphershow.com for information about this episode or any one of our others. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. Also, one more time, find The Cypher on iTunes. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Approach it the same way I would approach anyone on the street.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I don't like what the role religion has played in terms of being a catalyst and the justification for a lot of intolerance.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Word association rap.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher. Mm-hmm.